Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we learn about an unusual art project where two men took a suggestion box through the streets of New York. We hunt for the car James Dean was killed in, and we have our annual chat with an Illinois ghost hunter. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. The words art gallery may conjure up images of hushed murmurs and wine and cheese receptions. Chris Lehman visited a gallery in DeKalb that offers art lovers a chance to mingle in a much more casual environment.
The patrons at Bad Dog Gallery clutch cigarettes and cans of Pabst Blue Ribbon. Some ponder the work on the walls. Others simply chat with friends.
He was like the most incredible distance runner.
The first thing newcomers to Bad Dog Gallery probably notice is its location, Karen Brown's garage. The second thing they probably notice is the name.
Bad Dog Gallery is called Bad Dog Gallery because we didn't have a name, and you can't put a sign out advertising your business in this part of DeKalb. But I thought, yeah, well, I could still have a sign, you know, just like a normal sign, like keep off the grass. So we went to the hardware store to see what kinds of signs they had, and they had a, you know, no trespassing and no parking and no nothing. But the best sign was a yellow sign that said, "Warning, bad dog."
So she bought the sign and put it in her front yard, but someone stole it. Now she has a small metal sign in her front door that says the same thing. Bad Dog Gallery mainly showcases the work of current and former NIU art students. Brown is a professor of art at the school. She started the garage-based gallery about 3 years ago.
It was really fun to get it going and get it started and see the students sort of rise up and come up with ideas for, you know, what they could do in the space. And as long as that keeps happening, then that's what the gallery does.
The three-car garage dates from the late 1920s. It's been divided into two rooms. Brown has added drywall and track lighting. Unlike some galleries where shows can last several months, the exhibits at Bad Dog Gallery are of the here today, gone tomorrow variety. After an initial opening reception, the exhibits are open by appointment only. Brown tries to host a new show in her garage about once every 2 weeks. Suzanne Gorgas had a piece in a recent show. The Iowa native completed her graduate studies in art at NIU this past spring. Her piece at Bad Dog took up an entire room.
First of all, it's a pink room with text, completely filled with text. The text itself is a repeated fragment of a sentence. And so just probably seven different words that don't really make too much sense together, repeated over and over and over again in lines all the way around the room.
Karen Brown says Bad Dog Gallery also hosts shows of the more traditional picture frame on the wall variety. But she says Bad Dog Gallery is a place where artists can try out new things.
It's here because of student interest. And at the point that students stop being interested in needing a place to show their work, it'll cease to be Bad Dog Gallery and I'll park my car inside.
Until then, Brown plans to host shows in her East Garden Street garage in DeKalb. If you're thinking of stopping by, but you're worried about just how bad that dog is, have no fear. Brown says she doesn't actually have a dog. I'm Chris Lehman.
You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. The suggestion box, a fixture in offices, restaurants, and stores where one deposits notes on how to make things better, has now hit the road thanks to two New York artists. These two, Michael McDevitt and Otis Kriegel, carried their suggestion box through the five boroughs of New York and gathered up over 1,800 handwritten suggestions over the last 3 years. A selection of these can be found in their new book, Suggestion. It's published by Chronicle Books. I talked with one half of the suggestion box pair, Michael McDevitt, and asked him to explain their project and how it came to be.
Well, the suggestion box project started from sitting around a table, sort of brainstorming. It's part of a larger project called Illegal Art, and what we intended to do, sort of the mission statement, was to get art pieces out to the public where they would interact with the piece and then in turn make a third piece, which can be viewed whether through a photograph or a written piece, such as what we're doing with Suggestion Box. Now, Suggestion Box just came about because what we're trying to do is just take some of the mundane, normal things in life that are all around us and make it into something a little bit different. So the Suggestion Box was, you know, in your Super 8 hotel. It was at the local restaurant and or any place, you know, but not many people, even in the workplace, I would say, not many people interacted with it or actually put in suggestions that would be read or acted upon. So what happened was we went out with the box. Actually, I went home one night after the meeting, took an old box from sitting around the house, painted it up with White House paint and then spray-painted letters on it, brought it back the next week, and then we're off to an area here in New York called Union Square. What we had clipboards on it, we had pens, and put it out in the middle of the park. No one got near it, within 10 feet of it. And then what happened was Otis and I picked it up after being a little bit dejected, and we were out there for about an hour and a half, and nothing really happened with it. And we're walking down Fifth Avenue, and we see this couple come towards us, and a smile came across their face, and almost simultaneously Otis and I said, "Hey, would you like to make a suggestion?" And that's what sort of started the whole thing going.
And then you took this project to other parts of New York as well.
Right. What we did was we really thought the neighborhoods, each neighborhood would have something different to say. New York is, you know, split up into five boroughs, and we made it a point to get to all the boroughs, all the different types of neighborhoods, economic type of neighborhoods, just business neighborhoods, places where people gathered to rest, such as Central Park, or places where they were traveling to get home, such as the Staten Island Ferry. We went up to Yankee Stadium, where people enjoyed and played, out to JFK, where they, you know, came in and out of New York. So we try to get a flavor for all the people and all the boroughs of New York.
And when you were done, how many suggestions did you actually acquire, did you actually get in total?
I think we're above 2,000 suggestions or so just for the New York area, and it was whittled down to about 240 or so in the book.
Yeah, the book is absolutely fascinating to read because you reproduce the actual suggestion that was actually on the piece of paper. You take the person's handwriting and you just put a collection of those.
And right. I think that's a huge part of the project because it is in their own handwriting, all the spelling mistakes included, all the punctuation mistakes included. It really, you know, you see no one knows how to spell legal, no one knows how to spell marijuana, and it's really fun. You know, there was one, instead of a Lamborghini, it was a Lamborghini, and it's just fun to see that. And also some of the craziness with the handwriting. There's one guy who wrote a suggestion that wasn't all that great, but he underlined words two or three times just to make his point. Another guy had one suggestion. He had numbers one and two circled, and he had one suggestion, never ended up filling out two, number two. So it's pretty, you know, pretty telling about personalities, and you know, you see anger in handwriting, you see silliness, all sorts of things. I'd love to get a handwriting expert to take a look and give us a little bit of a psychological background on people.
So I'm sure with almost 2,000 suggestions that were put in the suggestion box, there had to have been recurring themes that appeared again and again and again.
Absolutely. There definitely were, and they did cross over from neighborhoods. You know, of course, we got a lot of world peace suggestions. We got a lot of legalized marijuana, three-day work weeks, or you know, or four-day work weeks, or three-day weekends. For some reason, we got a lot of free ice cream and lot of free beer. But there are, you know, other themes also about housing. You know, people very concerned about housing, about transportation, about government officials, what is being done for the poor, you know, across all the different areas also.
Were you surprised at any of the suggestions that appeared in the box, and which ones really stand out for you?
Well, it's funny. There's a lot of social ones, and it does allow people to sort of open up and be free to make any suggestions. One was Hasidic men should consider a lighter summer look, and we thought that was really good because it opens up an idea and a dialogue where people can say, you know, why is that person different? What's going on in their head or at their mind? And, you know, why are Hasidic men dressed, you know, head to toe in black and having all, you know, all these jackets? And it seems uncomfortable. Well, there's a reason behind it. I think, you know, to look beyond even the silliness of the suggestion and find out what's going on in social groups in different areas, you know, really can continue with dialogue. There are a lot of very funny suggestions, and that's, you know, it's the part of the humor there is a very beautiful thing. They are like spur-of-the-moment suggestions, like explore your elbows. You know, you never would think of doing that. Always keep a bucket of bleach on hand. You know, it sounds like a good idea, but where is that coming from? And just little things about, you know, our eating habits. One was obliterate the word carbohydrate. Please, all women enjoy dessert. So just down to little things like happen in our lives. One woman wrote about, I guess it was white, why the letters are white on a black buttons on control for a TV and not reverse it so you can see it a little bit better in the dark. So, that's the kind of stuff we're getting.
And ones that really made an impact, surprised you? Because I'm thinking of one in particular.
Okay.
Where you get the suggestion, don't break up with somebody on a bridge?
Yeah, that's part of the project that that is missing in the book in one instance, because we were up on the Brooklyn Bridge and it was a really cold, windy day, and we saw this woman and we just said, hey, you know, I'm going to make a suggestion. And she had a tear in her eye as we noticed that she is writing it, and even break was spelled incorrectly. And you know, we captured her in that moment, in a very personal moment, and it was, you know, it was quite touching. As opposed to that one, another one we got on the bridge was one that said, my friend Jonathan should kiss me. Now, Jonathan was standing right next to this woman and may never have known what she wrote. He may never have kissed her. So that, you know, that is definitely a moment that we shared while doing it. But hopefully what happens is, you know, when people do read the book, they put their own thoughts and insight into it. They, you know, paint their own mental picture, one that could be quite different than the experience that we had while gathering the suggestions.
I mean, it's a really interesting look into human behavior and human psychology that has really come out of this project. You get these anonymous, you know, somewhat anonymous notes that are put in this anonymous box.
Right.
And, you know, it's a weird expectation about who reads them. You know, where do they go once if you're the person writing the suggestion, once you write it and put it in the box,
right?
There's a weird sort of disconnect, but it's also liberating.
It's very liberating for these people. They can write down anything, and that's one thing people say, hey, you're not going to put my suggestion? Absolutely. Or what is it for? Well, it's for the box. You know, it's not for us, it's for the box. And different people are prompted by different reasons for making a suggestion, but they are anonymous, and whether they're answered in some way or whether it has any, it's a personal, very personal thing. It's, you know, quite a cathartic experience for everyone involved. And, you know, for us to open the box up at the end of the night, you know, certain ones we know who did something. You know, sometimes they fold it in a certain way and they put it away very secretively. You know, don't read this, and we sort of know who it is. Or other people share it at the very moment, say, hey, take a look at mine. What do you think of mine? But it's just a really wonderful way to get a snippet of what's going on in the street.
Have you gained any new insight because of this project?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think it really affirms the idea of don't judge a book by its cover, because some of the best and wackiest or, you know, most touching thing suggestions have been from people you wouldn't expect it to be from. We found, if you, I hate to say this, but, you know, you see a creative, young, hip-looking person coming down the street, you think you'd get something very interesting from them, and they are usually the most predictable and boring or mundane, and it's the, you know, the homeless guy on the street, or the, you know, the older woman walking her dog, the mother, you know, walking with a child, that just come up with the most unique, you know, like I suggest Chicken was just this, you know, guy sitting up at Central Park, and Explore Your Elbows was, you know, for a person you wouldn't expect to have such a, you know, smart idea. I think it really tells me and has told Otis and myself that there is creativity in all of us, and that was really what the whole project's about, is bringing art to the people and letting them know that they are creative and that they have a voice and that they can express it in some way. So I would say that we've been surprised. We've never not been surprised when we went out. We never knew what to expect when we went out with a box, and every experience has been totally different.
What would you tell people if approached by you or somebody else with a suggestion box?
I'd just say let it come from the heart. Don't think about it too much. Whatever comes first is the right one, is the right answer. It's they're carrying it around with them. You know, they have a suggestion, and don't think about it. Just write it down.
That was Michael McDevitt, who, along with Otis Kriegel, took a suggestion box through the streets of New York. Some of the suggestions they collected are in a new book called Suggestion. It's published by Chronicle Books. You're listening to Sidetrack. A veteran of the war in Iraq from Western Illinois has recently published a book about his experiences. A.J. Landman reports.
The book was written by Jason Adams from Toulon in Stark County, and it's called Active Duty, Letters to Home from Iraq, the longest 18 months in the life of a National Guard soldier.
I started writing emails to my dad and, you know, everybody in my friends list and my Yahoo account that, you know, because they didn't know. They kept asking me, well, what are you seeing? What's the place like? What are the people like? You know, what are you doing? What, you know, what's your average day like? And that kind of thing. And I realized that people really didn't have a good understanding of what was going on over there. I mean, they, you know, you watch the news and everything, but a lot of that is just a body count and the latest car bomb. So they didn't really have an understanding of what the average Iraqi was like, or, you know, a day in the life of a soldier kind of thing.
Adams joined the National Guard in 1991 and was called to active duty in the fall of 2003. After a year and a half, he returned home from Iraq last March.
I was going to college in 1991, and I pretty much ran out of money. I lost my job because, you know, here's an 18-year-old kid that doesn't realize that when the ground freezes, you can't dig fence posts, and that's what I was doing. I was digging fence posts for a fencing company, and I never foresaw that, hey, when the ground freezes, you're going to be out of a job, and it happened, and I was dumbfounded. I was sitting in my apartment in Sterling, Illinois, thinking, my gosh, what am I going to do? You know, I'm broke. I'm going to school, and if all of a sudden that Be All You Can Be commercial came on TV, and I thought, well, you know what, why not?
Chapter 1 in his book contains letters about training to go overseas. Then from Chapter 2 on, he writes about his experiences in Iraq.
And I want people to understand what we're trying to do. And I don't want it to be a political, you know, I don't want people to say, oh, this guy's just a, you know, Republican, or this guy's just a, you know, this or that. You know, I don't want it to be that. I want people to see what their soldiers, and I say their soldiers, are doing over in Iraq, you know, and that's my goal. The alternative, or the, not really alternative, but the my other goal is this book is going to help pay my way through nursing college. So, you know, because I want to be a nurse, you know. I want to spend the rest of my life just helping people.
In Iraq, Adams served as a medic for the 1st Battalion of the 202nd Air Defense Artillery.
But the cool thing that happened was, we were, one car wreck in particular, we were standing there, and I was, you know, putting bandages on the guys that were banged up, and I don't know, it was their dad or uncle or something was there, and he spoke a little bit of English, and my commander was standing there talking to the guy, and, you know, my commander's asking him, well, yeah. You know, what do you think of America? What do you like President Bush and all this stuff? And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I don't believe he's asking him this. You know what I mean? But I heard the guy say, you know, I had my back turned to him, and I heard the guy say, you know, America good, Bush bad, and Saddam Hussein bad. And then I felt a hand on my shoulder, and I heard him say, "This man good, you know, he have mercy in his heart." And I thought, you know what, that's what I'm after.
5 months after his return from Iraq, Adams returned to college to study nursing in Peoria.
I'm very proud that we went, that I went. You know, I mean, I'm not a warmonger. I don't like the idea of hurting people, but I think that seeing what I saw over there, you know, when we went there, we didn't know what to expect, you know, because we're getting one story from the military back here, and we're thinking, well, is that true, or is that just, you know, bravado and patriotism, you know? But once we got there, what I saw was, I saw the chance for us to do just monumental amounts of good and humanitarian aid, you know. People, I saw a guy building a house out of mud bricks, you know, and his water was just, that his family drank was just disgusting. I mean, I wouldn't even bathe in it, and they're drinking it. I saw a chance to do some really good things, and we did. You know, we delivered water, and we built schools and refurbished schools and handed out candy to the kids, you know. We just tried to make people's lives better, and I think what we're doing there is right, you know. But, you know, I don't like the way we're having to do it. I guess if that makes sense. You know, I don't like the fact that we have to, you know, have an M16 in one hand and goodwill in the other.
Iraq War veteran and Illinois native Jason Adams. The title of his book is Active Duty: Letters to Home from Iraq, and it's published by Learnovation from Fishers, Indiana. I'm AJ Landman.
You're listening to Sidetrack. Last month, we featured an interview with Scott Reeves of Champaign, a man who recently won a regional meat cutting competition put on by his employer, Texas Roadhouse, as part of their Meat Hero Challenge. We have an update to that story. In early September, Reeves went to St. Louis for the next round of the competition. He put his meat cutting skills to the test and came up with a second place win. He now advances to the semifinals, which will be held in Louisville, Kentucky. Still to come on the program, James Dean's Death Car, an Illinois publisher whose book is being used in the television show Lost, and our annual chat with a ghost hunter. Stay tuned. Thank you. last week marked 50 years since the death of James Dean. On September 30th, 1955, Dean's life ended tragically on a California highway. He was 24. Many recently traveled back to his hometown of Fairmont, Indiana, to recall the man they knew before he became a cult icon. But most people only know of James Dean through his work and characters like Jim Stark.
You're tearing me apart!
What?
You say one thing, he says another, and everybody changes back again!
One piece of Dean's history, the 1955 Porsche 550 Spyder he commissioned while making Rebel Without a Cause, the car he was driving when he died, has its own strange Hollywood kind of story. Jeff Bossert spoke with Joe Lopez, director of the Volo Auto Museum, who's offering a $1 million bounty for anyone who finds the car.
Tell me why it's important at the museum and maybe personally to commemorate him.
Well, James Dean, as you know, is very special. He's more than an actor. He's a cultural icon, and he represents basically coolness for, you know, not only the generation that saw him in Rebel Without a Cause, but all the way down to, you know, anybody who knows anything about Hollywood or even Americana. I've been getting calls from Australia and England and Germany. They're just fascinated with the story and how somebody, like you said, could die so young before he was even really a Hollywood star and make such a great impact on him. Everything from art to blue jeans have been touched by his life.
This, I assume, is out of personal interest and something you wanted to do long before became a possibility to have something there.
Right. Well, it is personal for me, but maybe not like how you would think. George Barris is a good friend of mine. He's the person who created the Batmobile and the Munster cars and that sort of thing. And George and I were cruising one night on a GTO on the back streets here where I'm at, out in Volo, Illinois, and he just remarked on how the street intersection reminded him of James Dean, who was his friend, and how he had died. And he told me the whole story, told me how the car had been missing, and told me, you know, that's one of his goals before he goes, is he wants to have that car back, he wants it back in the public, and to be able to pass on the story. And this was about 2 years ago, and so we came up with the idea to wait till the 50th anniversary and make a real effort to try to get that car back for him. George, he's the one who customized the car for James, and then when he died, George bought the wreck and was touring it as part of a police convention national tour, and they used it. You know, looking at it now, it seems a little bit heartless and maybe callous, but to basically show kids, you know, anybody could die if they're speeding. It could happen even to the biggest Hollywood stars, so you need to be careful when you're in cars and that sort of thing. The car was stolen from Florida in 1958, right after one of those conventions. It was George's goal to try to restore it to the point where he could even tell it was a car. After James wrecked it, it looked more like a torn-up piece of tinfoil. I mean, this was really thin metal. These cars were not built for safety. It was a race car that was street legal on the side. It was only about 3 feet tall, and the aluminum, if you kicked it hard enough, your foot would go through it. So there wasn't much left to it. George got the idea of trying to restore some parts of it. He took off the passenger side door and pounded that back out. That passenger side door was in his shop when the car was stolen, so that's the only part that remains, and that's what we have on display right now.
So it was in his hands, and because of George's desire to exhibit it and expose other people to what, well, not only that, I guess the dangers of traveling at high speeds, but his love for James Dean, it turned up missing.
Yeah. It was supposed to be put on a semi-truck and then transferred to a train and shipped back to George in Hollywood. What George received was an empty container. So it was most likely an inside job or somebody who had enough money and enough pull to be able to get that car and be able to pay off the shipping yard and everybody else who was involved and had to sign off on it. That's the type of lead that I'm coming up with, is it's somebody who's almost an untouchable, and we're getting pretty close. I'd say we're about at 85% of what we need to prove it right now.
So is this, I mean, involving a lot of detective work?
There's been detectives hired, and they've basically all failed. This is more using the public and using people out there who have firsthand knowledge and trying to get to them. And by offering $1 million for the car, we've had people come forward who have been quiet now for almost 50 years, type of people that wouldn't talk to a detective if they knocked on the door, but are willing to pick up the phone and make an anonymous call now that they know
who's interested and who's looking for it.
Well, tell me about the car in its original state and why James Dean loved it so much, and it's something that George so badly wants to see restored.
Well, in 1955, Porsche 550 Spyder is one of the purest Porsches ever built. It had no other purpose except basically fun. It was about 3 feet tall. It was a two-seater, had a pretty powerful engine, and it would just fly, and there was nothing in between the driver and the car. It was, you know, when you sit in something like that, you're almost at one with the machine. You don't worry. There's no air conditioning. There's no radio. There's nothing that gets in the way. Even the interior is basically just machined aluminum. There's no wood, no leather, nothing like that to try to, you know, take away from the actual driving experience. So those cars right now, when in good condition, goes for about $500,000.
Have you had any dialogue with fans that have come through and looked at
oh,
what...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We've had people trucking in whole busloads of people from, you know, his hometown and other places, and they're just happy that somebody's picked up the torch and is trying to move forward with this and find that car. I think it's important to those fans that the story, you know, have an ending. I mean, right now it's the mystery car, it's the death car. There's, you know, it's been associated with curses, and it's just kind of, you know, an unsolved mystery that people want closure for.
How many leads do you have on this without naming any names?
I have one really strong lead. I have about 200. A lot of them are just crazy people calling me. And, you know, they send me a picture of a Jaguar, and I'm like, no, that's not it. Or a replica. You know, they make a lot of Porsche 550 replicas, and somebody will spot it in the garage and think that their neighbor has the James Dean death car and stuff like that. But the one that I'm really counting on is pretty strong. We're actually planning a trip out there to take a look at it ourselves and talk to the owner and see if we can't come to some agreement on it. To keep it locked in your warehouse isn't fair to the public, isn't fair to James Dean fans, isn't fair to car guys. And really, it's kind of like, you know, you've stolen the Mona Lisa. You can't sell it. And you're hogging something that belongs to everybody, and we'd like to work it out. We're not looking to have anyone arrested or, you know, bothered by the police or the FBI or anything like that. We just want the car.
Jeff Bosser talked with Joe Lopez, director of the Volo Auto Museum, about the search for James Dean's 1955 Porsche. More information about the Lake County Museum and its exhibits is available online at volocars.com. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. The television show Lost is one of those stump-the-audience mysteries in which the characters on the show and the viewers, all 23 million of them, try to figure out where they are and what's going on. The most recent episode featured a book published by Dahlke Archive Press, a not-for-profit organization at Illinois State University serving readers and writers of contemporary literature. Charlie Schlenker recently talked with Chad Post, Dahlke Archives Associate Director, about the book.
How will the book The Third Policeman by Flann O'Brien be used on the show?
We're not sure exactly why the book's being used, but the scriptwriter and the executive producer have indicated that it's being used for a very specific reason and provides some sort of answers to some of the questions that the viewers have had since the beginning of the show.
There's been publicity with the screenwriter saying people who read the book will have a leg up in figuring out the mysteries on the show. What's the impact of that statement then?
That statement came out in the Chicago Tribune article last Wednesday, and in the 2 days following the appearance of that article, there was a lot of discussion of this on the Lost message boards among all of the fans, and we sold 8,000 copies in those 2 days.
What's the usual print run of a Dalkey Archive issuance?
The usual print run is between 4,000 and 6,000 copies, so 8,000 is spectacular sales.
And how long has The Third Policeman been out?
It's been out since 1999. We reprinted it thanks to an anonymous donation that set up a Jack F. Byrne Irish literature series. And over the past 6 years, we sold the book fairly well. It's taught in a lot of classrooms. We sold about 15,000 copies. But because of this article and because of its upcoming appearance on the TV show, it's now our best-selling book of all time.
What's the book about?
The book is very interesting. It's a very funny book. But it begins with a character, the narrator, who's unnamed throughout the entire novel. And he goes with one of his friends and kills someone to try and steal their money. They leave the money in the person's house for a number of days until things settle down. And then our narrator goes back to retrieve the money. Something strange happens when he opens up the box where the money's supposed to be. And then he's into this odd kind of limbo-esque realm. And at the end of the book, you find out that he's been dead since that moment in time. And along the way, between when he goes back to get the money and the very end of the book, he meets a number of policemen. They introduce him to the Eternity Factory, which for viewers of the show will have a great significance because they go down in this hatch to this realm where you can get anything that you want, be it gold, be it bicycles, but you can't bring it back up to the surface. And for fans of the show, this will seem like a very important clue.
So what are the theories about its significance?
There's a number of theories. On the season premiere of the show last week, the main characters went down into this hatch and found someone living under there. And in The Third Policeman, as I mentioned, they go down to this Eternity Factory, and there's certain resemblances between the way that the Eternity Factory is described and the hatch that appeared in the show. But there's also other speculation involving the way that the book has a number of nested narration. There's a scene with a box that a policeman takes out a smaller box inside of that, and a smaller box, and a smaller box, and a smaller box. And there's also a scientist that appears in the book named DeSelby, who's a lot of crazy pseudoscientific theories about life being the great illusion and death being the extreme illusion, and about how night is just a collection of dust particles in the air, about how the world is sausage-shaped. All these theories seem to play into Lost. So there's a number of people are speculating about almost every aspect of this book and how it could pertain to the show.
Why did Craig Wright, the screenwriter for Lost, say he wanted to use the book?
He told me that he's a fan of the book, and in writing for the show, he thought that the book was a perfect tool in sort of explaining some of these mysteries or answering some of the questions, and he's a huge fan of Dalkey Archive as a whole. But he won't give away much.
Is the author of The Third Policeman, Flann O'Brien, still alive? What was he like?
No, he died a number of years ago. He wrote The Third Policeman. He's an interesting character. He's an Irish comic writer. One of the things that bothered him through his whole life is none of his books sold very well. In fact, The Third Policeman was written in the 1930s, and in 1940 he tried to get it published, and no one published it. So he started this rumor that the book was lost, that his agent had misplaced it, the book was gone forever. In reality, he kept it in a drawer and hid it for a number of years, and it wasn't published until after he died. In the meantime, he wrote a book that used some of the same materials as Third Policeman, including DeSelby, the scientist from The Third Policeman, and entitled this book The Dalkey Archive, which is where the name of our press comes from. He died in the mid-60s, and Third Policeman came out, and now, thanks to a TV show in America that's immensely popular, he's finding his audience, and he's probably rolling in his grave.
In laughter.
In laughter.
So what are you doing to get ready for exposure to 23 million viewers?
Well, we reprinted 10,000 copies when we first found out that the book was going to appear on the show. But because of the sales last week, we're going to go back to press and reprint another 7,500 to 10,000.
You're known for literature, for perhaps more difficult fiction. Certainly not what the usual television audience would be looking for. Do you expect any longer-term benefits?
I think that we will have some longer-term benefits. I think people are discovering Third Policeman through Lost, which I need to say is a very literary show. They've had other references to books on the show, including Watership Down, A Wrinkle in Time, and there's a number of subtle allusions, like one of the characters is named Locke, one is Rousseau. So it's a very literary show, and it's a great show that blends pop culture and high literature and is directing people back to literature and back to reading. So I think after fans discover Third Policeman and Dalkey Archive, I think that they'll start reading more of our books, or at least paying attention, because there's a certain cachet that goes along with being on the TV show Lost.
The Third Policeman is available at chain bookstores through Amazon or directly through Dalkey Archive Press. Chad Post is the associate director of the publishing house that publishes alternative fiction and reprints. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We'll be right back.
This is Sidetrack. One of our traditions here on the show is to check in with a ghost hunter every October, in anticipation of Halloween, of course. This year, we called up Troy Taylor again. He's a ghost hunter and one of the founders of the American Ghost Society, based in Alton, Illinois. He's written several books on the subject of ghosts, including Haunted Illinois, The Ghost Hunter's Handbook, and his latest book, Ghosts on Film. To start this year's conversation, I asked him what he's been up to since last we talked.
This past year has been a little bit different for me. While I'm still, obviously, doing all of the ghost stuff that I've always done, I got involved in a new project for Barnes & Noble called Weird Illinois, which was a new book that it came out in the spring. And it's a little different from the stuff I've done in the past because it's a big hardcover book. And it's not all ghosts. It's a big section on ghosts and graveyards and all the stuff that I normally do, but it had a lot of unusual stuff in it, too. So it got me. To make a long story short, it got me traveling all over the state. And, of course, when people found out what I do, they were interested not only in the weird stuff, but, of course, in the ghost stuff because that's what I had written previously. And, you know, everybody's got a story, which is always great. And that really got me started on some new locations and some new things that I'd been doing. One place that I had been interested in the past, but I'd really never done a whole lot with, was a little abandoned town in kind of north, not really northwestern Illinois, but kind of north central and western Illinois, called Vishnu Springs. And it's an abandoned town now. But at one time, it was really a thriving community that had been built up around a natural spring, a water spring that was supposed to have, you know, healing capabilities. What's neat about the location was it was down in a valley area, and it's very secluded. It's very dark, even in the daytime. It's really overcast and dark down there. The spring is still there, but the town was built up around the spring. It was a man named Darius Hicks who really started the community, and by attracting people to the spring, he soon had a really thriving town going with stores and saloons and homes and an amusement park even and a huge grand hotel that they built there in town. And it attracted a lot of people, which really was odd because it was so far really off the beaten path. It's very hard to get to back in those days, from the late 1800s. There was no railroad that went even near there. Really, Macomb was the closest railroad, and that was some distance, and people had to go by wagon to make it to Vishnu Springs. So the fact that he drew such a large community was kind of surprising in itself. But the community really did well for a while, but then people started to kind of drift away because they were kind of turned off by some of the things that were going on. Darius Hicks had some interesting proclivities, let's just say. He was married on several occasions, sometimes to more than one person at a time, and eventually actually married his stepdaughter. And I think at that point, people started to kind of shy away from the things that were going on and began drifting out of the area. And eventually the town was abandoned. They just couldn't keep it going anymore. Today, the town is mostly gone. I mean, there are some foundations left, some ruins. The spring is still there. You can find pieces from the old merry-go-round at the amusement park. Goldfish ponds that were put in are still there. And the only thing really, the main structure still standing is the old hotel, because it was actually used as a residence in later years. There was a commune there for a while in the early 70s. Where people came in and lived and grew, let's just say, were growing herbs all around the property, which was, I guess, very interesting from what I've been told by several people who lived there at the time. And the town now is gone. I mean, there's nothing really there. There's no people living there, just the hotel. But what's interesting about it is I kept hearing all these ghost stories. I kept hearing about people who had gone out to Vishnu Springs and had been there and had heard the sounds of, you know, what seemed to be a town still going. People talking, laughing, hearing horses, music, all kinds of the banging sounds, all kinds of things that appeared that someone was still around. They'd search through the whole area and never find anybody there. And I've heard this quite a few times from different people. I've been out there a couple of times, and while I will admit to it being probably one of the spookiest, most eerie places I've ever been, I never really experienced anything for myself. I just have people's word for it that they've had these odd experiences. But it was definitely a place that really attracted my attention.
Now, this is really interesting. When you get these stories from people, do you go there just to document and research, or do you have another purpose for going and visiting these places?
Well, I mean, I go for more than one reason. I mean, I go because I want to see the place. I want to hear the place that they told me about. I want to, you know, document as much as I can, take some photographs, take a look around. You know, I want to research any history that I can find, you know, actually at the location that I can't get, you know, just by looking it up, you know, at the library or something. But, you know, a lot of times I go, especially places that are supposed to be very active, I will go with the idea that, you know, who knows what might happen. You know, people ask me about, you know, weird experiences I've had. You know, has that ever happened to you? Have you ever felt like you've been touched? Have you ever felt like someone's touched your clothing or, you know, things like that? And, you know, I can a lot of times say, yeah, I've had some very odd experiences. And usually that comes from the fact that I go to so many of these places. It's not like, and I know you and I have talked about this in the past, I am a psychic as a fence post. I don't see dead people, I don't talk to dead people, you know, nothing like that. You know, my whole thing is that, you know, if something odd happens, it's because I've somehow become a part of the story. And that's an odd thing to have happen, but, you know, I think my weird experiences have been out of sheer numbers more than anything else. I've just been to so many places. But, you know, I go with the hope that maybe something will happen just so I can see for myself if I really think there's, you know, a genuine haunting there.
Now, you talked about researching these places, you know, when people say, this place, I've heard stories about it. How do you search it out? You said you kind of look for stuff that you can't find anywhere else. How exactly do you do that?
Well, the research end of it usually involves trying to track down, you know, people who have had experiences. Or, you know, surprisingly, you know, amazingly, really, a lot of times I can find, you know, information in old files and records and newspapers and books, you know, all kinds of places like that actually have been either overlooked or that people just aren't that familiar with. Earlier this year, I did a book on Abraham Lincoln and the supernatural. And I thought, you know, it was something that, you know, a lot of people are familiar with, but it never really been all compiled into a single book before. And that was really my goal. And I actually stumbled across an old book that had been written by a medium who had been friends with Mary Lincoln and had conducted many seances at the White House. And she had actually written a book about her experiences. And it was written like in 1917. I'd never run across it before. I'd never seen it cited anywhere where anybody had ever written on Lincoln and the supernatural. So I used some material from that. I cited it. I mentioned some of the things that she talked about and talked about some other things about Lincoln that I found in kind of some more obscure places. And you would be amazed by the number of people who have come to me and said, oh, God, I've read so many books about Abraham Lincoln, but I never knew this. So that's what I go for. I look for that kind of stuff. I look for kind of the odder side of history, you know, the darker side a lot of times. That's just not the general stuff that you're going to get hand-fed to you through, you know, regular history books or history class in school. So it's just a matter, I mean, I love doing the research, so it's just a matter of looking for it. You know, it's there. It's just a matter of whether or not people want to look for it.
And you think a good part of our history is tied in with ghost stories.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are so many historical events in American history that have ghost stories connected to them. I mean, just about anything. You know, I've always said that about Illinois, that there's not any major event in Illinois history that doesn't have a ghost story somehow connected. And American history is the same way. And, you know, everything from, obviously, from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War to minor events that have taken place, there's so many ghost stories out there. And it's too bad that that's so, you know, overlooked by the, you know, quote unquote, you know, real historians. They don't want to, they think that that's a, you know, something that should be discounted instead of being embraced as a real, you know, oral, traditional part of our history.
Do you think with the recent Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans and the Gulfport area and Hurricane Rita, do you think we're going to hear a lot of ghost stories associated with these these modern events?
We will from New Orleans.
You think
so? I don't think there's any question. You know, I did a book on New Orleans a number of years ago, and it's been a great seller. It's picked up recently, which, you know, I've been tempted to just kind of pull the whole thing because I actually had planned on doing an updated edition of the book anyway. In fact, I was supposed to be in New Orleans next week. I had days set aside in October. Some friends and I were going to go down to New Orleans and spend a few days, and I was actually getting some of the material that I had ready for me down there to update the book. So I've decided to put that off and update it. I mean, from what I've been hearing, a lot of the soldiers who have gone down, the National Guardsmen have gone down to help out, have been having supernatural experiences at some of the places they've been staying and all kinds of stuff. So I definitely think there's going to be, you know, more material. And it's New Orleans, and New Orleans is great about embracing that kind of stuff. So they never shied away from ghosts. And I think that they'll be the first people to talk about it. So I guess we'll see.
So you're basically saying with any major traumatic event that it does have repercussions about what goes on afterwards?
Well, I think so.
You think
so? I definitely think so. A lot of times it's just whether or not people are ready to talk about it yet. You know, I honestly, there were ghost stories coming out of September 11th. A few people were ready to talk about it. Most people weren't. But there were ghost stories already people talking about. I shied away from that because I found that to be a little bit much. You know, in 50 years, people want to tell ghost stories about that, and that's one thing. But I think that's something that's too fresh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. It's hard to how do you define. So what's different about, you know, Hurricane Katrina and September 11th? What's different? Well, I think one's a natural disaster and one isn't. You know, I think the disasters created by the hand of man seem a little bit darker and a little bit too fresh. Where Katrina was a case of where, you know, nature, you know, played its part and people aren't so shied away from talking about it, I guess. I don't know. I guess we'll see. You know, I guess we'll see.
Do you think that these ghost stories, and, you know, maybe I'm thinking on a skeptic side who, you know, might not believe in ghosts and the supernatural, but do you think that this idea of telling ghost stories and this folklore that comes around these major events is some way a coping mechanism?
Yeah, I do. I do think that that's a good part of it. I don't think that there's any mystery to the idea that, you know, the spiritualist movement really saw its strongest times in history. You know, even though it started prior to the Civil War, it really went through a rebirth after the Civil War. After World War I, it went through another huge, you know, explosion in popularity. And I think that that's a big part of it. People were looking for a way to understand what was going on. You know, that so many people died, and this was a way to, you know, they made contact with the dead, or they so they believed. And I think that was a great coping mechanism. And I think that you see it a lot, you know, with other disasters and with other terrible events that happen. I definitely agree with you on that.
If people have a good story to tell and might think a place is haunted and they want to tell somebody to look into it, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, they can always contact me. I'm easily reachable through the website at historyandhauntings.com. Right down at the bottom, you can email me and drop me an email, especially, you know, in October, the busiest time of the year. I may not get back to them right away, but, you know, that's the best way to always catch me. And I'm always interested in hearing about, you know, different locations, especially in Illinois, which are haunted. I've got a lot of projects in the works, and I'm definitely always interested in hearing about more.
Okay, before we go, tell us about one more of your more recent favorite Illinois haunted places.
Well, I don't actually, it's not necessarily a place, it's always a story, and it's a longtime favorite of mine, but it's one that I have gotten re-involved with recently. Into, you know, we're turning it into a real project, a real, you know, looking into finding the answers behind. And that's the story of Resurrection Mary. And we may have talked about this on another show in the past. But the story about Mary is she's a vanishing hitchhiker, really, on Archer Avenue, which is south of Chicago. And it's about a girl who died on the road, and ever since that time has been being picked up by, you know, really a lot of reliable people. She's been picked up by who have tried to take her home only to have her disappear from the car near Resurrection Cemetery. And, you know, it sounds like an urban legend, but it's one of those stories that has real people, real places, and real dates involved. We've even been able to track down a number of likely candidates for who Resurrection Mary may have been when she was alive. There seems to be sort of a legendary version, but there seems to be several very real girls who may have been candidates for it. A young woman named Mary Bergovi, who was a factory worker, who, while she doesn't fit the exact description as the legendary Mary, a lot of her friends who knew her when she was alive actually saw her ghost on Archer Avenue. There was a young girl whose name was Anna Norcus, who was about 13 years old, who died in a terrible accident after leaving the famous Willowbrook Ballroom. And she also was buried in Resurrection Cemetery, and many people have reported actually seeing her ghost as well. So we've come to think that, according to our research, that we think that there may be several ghosts who are actually, you know, the quote-unquote Resurrection Mary, that there's several ghosts who are actually playing that one part, because people are having a lot of very different experiences still to this day, and they've been going on since the 1930s. It's probably one of the longest-running, reliable hauntings I've ever run across. So that's something that I'm really heavily working on right now, and we'll continue to be working on it. We're planning on, a friend of mine and I, she writes the Chicago Haunt series, Ursula Bielski, and Ursula and I are actually putting together a book project on just Resurrection Mary, and we're doing a lot of research on this. So it's been very interesting, to say the least.
And is there an expected publication date for that?
We hope it should be out next year. It's just our research is becoming more in-depth than we had originally thought it would be. So probably in the coming year. So that's the plan anyway.
So for people who want to visit your website, what's that website address again?
It's www.historyandhauntings.com.
Well, Troy, thanks for joining us again to tell us about what's going on for haunted places in Illinois. And
all right,
we'll check in again next year.
Okay, thanks, Jason.
Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and we've started podcasting them as well. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.